Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Kristi Noem serves as South Dakota's lone member of the United States House of Representatives. She was elected in 2010 and re-elected to her third term in 2014. U.S. Representative Noem serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. Her caucus list includes the Military Sexual Assault Prevention Caucus, among others. Since we discussed sexual harassment and assault in the military during our conversation, first some numbers for context. More than 20,000 members of the military were sexually assaulted in 2014. That's 10,600 men, 9,600 women, 1 in 4 women, and 1 in 100 men who used the VA in 2013 screened positive for military sexual trauma. 86% of victims did not report their crimes. Those numbers are from a Department of Defense report and the RAND Military Workplace Study. I talked with Congresswoman Noem about military sexual assault. It's been one of her focuses over the years. But we also talked about what advice she might offer her younger self. We talked about how success means asking for help when you need it. And we talked about how she reaches out to women in South Dakota to encourage them to say yes to leadership opportunities through events such as the recent Women of Influence Conference. I want to start with the Women of Influence Conference, if you're okay with that. I'd like to know how did that event go?
Oh, it was wonderful. We had about 600 women RSVP for the event and come that day. And we had amazing panelists that came and spoke about their experiences. Some of them were CEOs of companies. Our special guest was Mary Hart, but also Angela Konecki was there moderating the panel discussion. We had several different women throughout South Dakota talk about their experiences in leadership and maybe some lessons learned, some advice for other women who were wanting to be more influential in whatever role they fill in their lives. And so it really just was a wonderful day spent together.
Did you learn anything from those women, speakers and the women who were your guests that day that you didn't already know or have a handle on?
Well, I think just a general theme of that, challenges aren't unique to just me. You know, every woman tends to run into certain things that get hard at one point or another. But if we approach them as a problem to be solved, that it really can make us better leaders at the end of the day. So I think most of the women, talking about regrets or opportunities that they missed, was just not trying it, not saying yes to an opportunity that came their way. So that tended to be the main theme of the day is when you get presented a new opportunity, just do it. Try it for a while. You don't have to commit to doing it for the next 20 years, but it may be something you find you have a talent or a gift for, or you may meet people that later on in your life you have a reconnection with that really further your career or become a very good friend of yours. And so it's always a way to learn in every single situation.
What were some of those reasons women were giving for not saying yes to an opportunity that came their way?
I think overwhelmed. Women will always struggle with trying to raise a family and balance that with their jobs or career that they have. But also, in the United States, the majority of women are paying the family bills. They're making the majority of the health care decisions. So they're juggling a lot of responsibilities, and it's one of those things that certainly I think every woman faces, and they recognize that they've got to focus on. And it's not unique to one individual, which we may feel sometimes.
How do you deal with the overwhelm? You have a very busy schedule. Do you get overwhelmed, and how do you approach it when you do?
I take it one day at a time, and then I have a lot of people in my life that help. I did not come into this position thinking I had to do everything myself. So I've got a wonderful family that helps me with the kids and responsibilities of mom and a mother-in-law. My sister picks up the slack when I'm out of town, and then when I'm home on the weekends, I certainly am pitching in, helping them with different things that they have responsibility for. So it definitely helps to have a village helping you accomplish all of your responsibilities. And I think that one of the things that will frustrate most women or cause them to feel unhappy with their lives is if they think they have to do everything all by themselves.
Do you give yourself time to think? Do you have time to read and to contemplate? Or are you pretty much, and when you're in Washington, always going from one thing to the next?
We just had this conversation a couple of minutes ago that I need 5 minutes just to sit at my desk and remember who I am.
Right.
Because, you know, in Washington especially, you know, you could have a meeting every 10, 15 minutes all day long. You'll get to the end of a day and realize you did 30 meetings, but you can't remember the ones you had that morning. So that does happen, although one of the habits that I've really gotten into and enjoy so much is getting up very early in the morning. I get up early. I spend a half hour just collecting my thoughts, maybe doing devotions, and then go down and I spend some time at the gym and get my exercise for the day, because the rest of the day I'll be sitting in meetings and not moving very much. And just having that 2, maybe 3 hours, if I'm up by 4 or 4:30 in the morning, to not necessarily have to be engaged but settle my thoughts and get ready for the day and feel prepared has made a world of difference. I feel like then I'm not playing catch up all day long.
Do I dare ask you what time you go to bed then?
Well, I want to go to bed at 7 p.m. that's when I want to go to bed. But yeah, my family laughs about it now that I've turned into this person. At home, I'll wake up at 3:30 every morning trying to tell myself to sleep a couple more hours. But then by 6 or 7 o'clock at night, I'm exhausted and they're trying to carry me off to bed. So I'm in bed by 9 out here, but that means, you know, back home, that's 8 p.m. And according to my kids, that's ridiculous.
There's some pushback there.
Yes, a little bit.
It's a tough audience. During the conference, there was some talk about personal mission statements, which I found interesting. And I'm wondering if you want to elaborate on what a personal mission statement is and why women and men should consider developing one.
Absolutely. Well, I believe in having a mission statement. It keeps your life focused, your day-to-day activities focused. If what you're filling your time with doesn't fulfill that mission statement, then you should really question whether you should be doing that activity. Mine is to live a life of integrity and service to others while spreading God's love through action. And it just lays out that and reminds me every single day that my job is to serve people and to be honest. And then also that we demonstrate what kind of person we are by our actions, not to always think that we demonstrate through words that we say. Words are important, but a lot of times what really means a lot to folks is what you do. Mm-hmm. And so that mission statement encompasses all of my priorities and values. And just by reading it, I remember, yes, that's what I need to focus on today. I have one for the office as well that keeps my entire staff focused on what our job is as an office. And it's that we're placed in our positions to serve the people of South Dakota. We set a godly example of leadership and excellence in all that we do. We need to deliver a more efficient, effective government that spends less, does better, and is genuinely accountable to the American taxpayer. This is our opportunity to proliferate American exceptionalism and freedom through our work. And I think when my staff read through that, I think most of them, or at least they used to, all of them have them taped to their computers or on their desk somewhere to remember that every day if we're doing something or taking part in something that doesn't line up with that mission statement, they shouldn't be doing it.
How do you handle setbacks like that when you look around, you say, I've gotten pulled into something that is outside what I want to be doing, or you were not successful through something that you wanted to achieve? How do you handle setbacks in moving forward?
Yeah, that's the biggest frustration that I have, especially since I've come to Washington, D.C. When I was in business before, running a farm and ranch and restaurant, a hunting lodge, you know, you could make decisions and implement them and see the results. You either were successful or failed, but out here I could have something I'm working on, a piece of legislation, something I'm trying to accomplish, and because I can't, you know, be the boss and tell every single member of Congress how to vote and what to do, it may not get done, and it may not get passed for months or even years. And that was very hard for me to adjust to. Even in South Dakota, when I was in the legislature there, if I had an idea, it at least got a hearing. We at least got to debate it. Now, out here, I may have a bill that I think is critically important for South Dakota, and it may never see the light of day. And so that is challenging, but I go back to that mission statement and know that my job is to serve others. And if I believe this truly does, I keep trying to think of new ways to get it accomplished. I've learned that in D.C., a lot of the things you're able to accomplish depend on relationships, that you may need to spend more time talking to people, sitting in their offices, educating them about why this is important, And if you take the time to build a relationship with them, they may end up helping you get it done too.
When you talk about action, and I personally think of the things you've done in Washington, one of the things that comes to my mind first is prevention of military sexual trauma. Maybe that's because I'm a veteran and I kind of followed that more closely. Why was that an issue? Why is that an issue that's important to you?
Well, because our military men and women know that they have to go to war and that they're in danger, but they shouldn't have to be in danger when they come back to the barracks, too. They should know that they're in a culture and family that protects them and cares for them. And some of the provisions that I had included in the NDAA over the years have put in guidelines that have helped change the culture, I think, in our different branches of the military. There was no requirements or specific guidelines for how to choose a sexual assault investigation officer. So one of the bills that I did was to do that. Others were to make sure that somebody who had a violation in their background could not fill that role, to make sure that these investigations were defined as founded or unfounded, and that people were more aware of how to conduct these investigations to get convictions if needed, and if that was the accurate action to take. So by putting those in place, we now are getting many more convictions and instances where there has been sexual assault, which I think is a win, because once we are able to bring these people to justice, I think it changes the entire dynamic that we have in our military, and it's deemed as no longer acceptable. Hmm. And the NDAA was just marked up in the House committee yesterday, and they put in some more provisions that had to do with professional retaliation, using rank that some female victims have said they've been subjected to a retaliation by rank being forced upon them. So while we're still waiting for some of the data, the provisions that I've had included in the NDA over the years are still being implemented, put into place. We needed uniform guidelines and training among all branches, which is another thing we were able to get accomplished. So every branch has uniform training that every single person will take when they sign up for the military. Yeah. Those are all critically important, and they're making a difference. And I think we're going to continue to see more and more benefits as we go through the years.
Do you know, when I was in, they didn't even have the term sexual harassment yet.
Yeah,
I was
shocking.
In the military when they sort of introduced what that was, and I remember the first meeting that we had where they said, "Oh, you can't do this."
Really?
And it's called, and they had to start that the very beginning idea of training that it wasn't even thought of before.
Right.
You must
well,
have had,
and I'm that's the shocking thing about that is that it was going on.
Right, right.
So at that point in time, it wasn't something that they talked about, but it was ongoing, and people were suffering through it with no accountability to getting it stopped.
It was those early people who started speaking out. So you must have had pushback from people who said women shouldn't even be there in combat. How did you overcome the notion of sort of just a general conflict about what women's role is in the military today?
Yes, every discussion that we had in doing the NDAA bill, which is the authorizations and funding that's necessary to take care of our military every year, we had the discussion on it if women should be there or not. Mm. I think what people forget is that hundreds of thousands of women served during World War II in the military to defend this country. They did all different kinds of jobs and filled in to defend this country. And when we become citizens of this country, we pledge to protect and defend America. And so I think that people don't realize that women have always taken this responsibility and to defend our country. And this is certainly something that if they want to do, and if we truly believe that all opportunities should be open to our young girls and young women choosing careers, then why should they not be able to serve in the military? I don't want to see us lower standards. I think that we have standards in the military, physical, tactical, mental standards that everybody needs to meet. But if a woman can meet those standards, then absolutely, why shouldn't they serve in that role?
Your name, switching subjects a little bit, your name comes up, I'm sure you know, frequently as a governor candidate for South Dakota. Where do you think you can do your best work for the people of South Dakota? You've expressed some frustration with Washington, but where do you think you're best suited right now?
Well, I'm running for re-election to the House.
Right.
I know that I'm not done here. I I came out here frustrated with the policies that were coming out of Washington, D.C., and while we've been able to accomplish some of those, I know I still have more work to do. So I'm focused on that. I think that, you know, there's always a time when you have to file papers for re-election where you evaluate, you know, if you're willing to do that again. I always make that decision with my family, and we'll have that conversation probably in a time period. But right now, we're just really focused on all the things I've got on my plate out here and certainly on getting through this next election, too.
Talk to me a little bit about IHS, because I'm new to that area of conversation, and it's confusing to me that there are so many problems you're very interested in.
Me too.
Lay it out for me. Why is this so broken?
It's been broken for decades, and it was broken before I ever got here. And since I've been here, trying to get through the bureaucracy to figure out exactly what the problem is has been one of my biggest frustrations, because IHS is failing miserably at providing health care to our Native Americans and to our tribes. But when I try to get information or facts from them or try to figure out where the dollars are going, they're not always forthcoming with that. So that's one of my biggest challenges. I've got several different legislative ideas that I'm working on, but we also have an oversight role that Congress has with these agencies and departments. I actually just met a few minutes ago with a Senator Dorgan, who's from North Dakota, who had done an aggressive investigation 5 years ago into the Great Plains region and the abuses that were ongoing there. And we talked about what he learned during that investigation, some of the actions that I can take into the future, too. But I think that those hospitals right now is what we're facing, being shut down with Pine Ridge and Rosebud, trying to get folks in there that will open them up, provide contract care for a period of time that will truly serve those communities is very important. Part of my discussions with Mary Smith, who is the director of IHS right now, is that I'm not interested in doing things how IHS has always done them. They want to do a short-term contract to get somebody in there to reopen those emergency rooms to take care of our tribal members. I want a long-term contract with local providers who know what it's like to deal with the rural challenges that we have in those areas of the country and who are going to be around for a long period of time. I think Avira and Rapid City Regional Health, Sanford, they should all have opportunities to bid for these contracts because they're the ones who know what it's like to deliver health care in South Dakota, and they're not going to go away. I think what's always happened in the past with IHS is they look to other nationwide companies or hospital systems that could do that, and maybe they don't stay for a long period of time. And so I'm looking at solutions like that to get long-term contracts in place, get better health care, but also we've got to figure out why IHS bureaucracy tends to move people around. They don't tend to fire people who are failing at their jobs. They move them to a different position. We've got to deal with the leadership, and we've gotten them to change some leadership already just by the recent questions that I've asked in committee hearings and discussions I've had with the tribes and IHS officials. They have made some leadership changes, but we've got to get the right leadership in place to truly reform the whole agency.
So some of the things that you mentioned about IHS, we could change a couple letters or one letter and say IRS, and there's some similarities with hiring and firing of people. So I'm sensing a theme. You're not a fan of bureaucracy. How do you overcome the frustration of something that's been, and what gives you the guts to think that you can change it if it's been broken for so long?
Yeah. Well, you go and listen to the stories of people affected, and it makes you keep working at it. So, and I'm not, I guess maybe not being a lifelong politician or somebody who really thought they would be in this role my whole life, that makes me try to look at it a little bit differently than maybe everybody else does. I don't want to perpetuate government. I would much rather see it reformed. And we are having some problems with IRS, too. Congress has a formal role of providing oversight to agencies and departments. We give them opportunities to change. If they don't, then we address it through legislation. The IRS bill that I had last week did that specifically. The IRS was rehiring individuals who'd been fired for misconduct. And we told them through a report that their rehiring of hundreds of these types of individuals was not acceptable, and they chose to keep their policy the same. So, which meant they were rehiring people to work in the IRS that had been fired for stealing, for falsifying information, for accessing sensitive taxpayer information. Even one employee had been gone for 8 weeks worth of work without a reason, had been fired, stamped on their personnel file, do not rehire, and still the IRS rehired them. So when they do not change their ways, then that's when Congress does legislation and passes it to force them to. So that is the same approach we're using with IHS, is we see problems, we're drawing light to them, we're going to try a different approach for providing health care. If that does not work, then my legislative reforms will be ready to go, and we'll be pushing them hard that will make the changes that are necessary.
Are you more optimistic now than when you first came to Washington, less or about the same?
You know, when I first got here, I was very optimistic. But I would say that I quickly learned how slow Washington, D.C. works, and how even the process is broken. You know, not in South Dakota, when you do have a bill, it gets a hearing. If it passes out of committee, it automatically goes to the House floor. If the House passes it, the Senate has to deal with it. There's a process that has to be followed. There isn't one out here. So if the House could pass a bill and the Senate could just ignore it and never deal with it, which means it can never reach the president's desk. So even just restoring that process would help us get things a lot more accomplished. And I've just learned different ways to get things to people's attention. I've learned that I have to educate members, spend a lot of time working with them. And that's a little bit of a tough job when you're from a state like South Dakota, where you only have one representative. If something's important to South Dakota, I'm the only one out there pitching it, working it, trying to get it done. I know if somebody from California wants something that's important to California, they've got over 50 members that, you know, they can help get the job done. And that's a little bit of an advantage when it comes to trying to get policies done that are important to a whole state. So I have learned that I will build coalitions. Maybe on agriculture, I've got a group of individuals that I always work with on agriculture issues. If there's something on tax reform, there's a group of members that I know are very interested in that I work with. If there's something on IHS, I go to all the members that have tribes in their district or are dealing with problems. And I feel like I've gotten to know, I probably have a broader range of knowledge about and relationships with the members than maybe others do.
It must take years to build some of those relationships and the depth of them with everybody, you know, having their attention pulled all different directions. Do you think it improves the longer you're in Washington?
It can, although I think some of the members that come to Washington and move here and live here, I think they lose some of their impatience to get things done, or they get used to how slow it is and adapt to it. There's a bit of insulation on Capitol Hill from what the real world goes through. You know, what keeps me pushing so hard and impatient to get things done is the fact that I'm home every weekend in South Dakota talking to people who are impacted by these terrible regulations or impacted by poorly run government health care, or you know, veterans who are suffering by not having a clinic nearby. You know, when you go to church with them and you see them at the gas station and you go to ball games and sit next to them, you go back to D.C., it's almost, you know, just like a pep talk every single week, is we've got to get this fixed and we've got to get it fixed now, where I think if members move out here and stay for years and years, you know, they lose some of that. They don't necessarily have that constant feedback that keeps you going.
Now, since you do come home often, you must hear lots of talk about the Republican prospects of an open convention. People talk about John Thune's name being thrown around. I mean, just us, nobody outside South Dakota, maybe. But
well, you do hear it sometimes. I actually got an email from somebody that I think was from New York State that said, "Hey, John Thune would make a great vice president." And I go, "Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly." So, you know, I do think he's highly respected in South Dakota and outside of South Dakota. I think he's always been a hard worker. He's got integrity, and he's somebody who offers solutions, doesn't just complain. So, you know, the presidential election has been interesting to watch. I think people are looking for a leader that knows how they feel and how angry they are at how broken Washington, D.C. is, but they also want somebody who knows how to get stuff accomplished.
Do you think Kristi Noem would make a great vice president?
Well, her husband did not sign up for that. he didn't know when he married me he was getting into this job, so he's doing very well. But no, I've still got kids that we, and I love South Dakota too much. It is, when I can come home and just even step off the plane on the weekend, and it feels like detox for me. I have learned that I am not a city person. So for me, I can do this for a few days, but if I had to do it where I couldn't come home, I wouldn't be able to do it very long.
I know you have to get going back to many things on your schedule, but one last question.
Sure.
Tying back to the Women of Influence Conference, any advice you would give to your younger self? I know that was one of the topics of discussion. Have you had a bit of time to think about that, advice you would give to a younger Christy Noem?
Yeah, well, I asked all the other ladies that. I don't know if I answered it for sure, but, you know, for me, just say yes to everything. The first time that I got that advice from somebody was from my grandma. It was when my first daughter was born, and we were at the baby shower, and they went around the room and had everybody give the new mom, you know, me, some new advice. And my grandma said, Christy, say yes, because so many times as a mom, you have to say no. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, I don't want to be a mom who just says no all the time. So I really made a decision that day. If my kids wanted to race down the driveway, we raced down the driveway. And we have a long driveway. But if they wanted to jump in a mud puddle on Easter Sunday, we did. You know, we just decided to do that. But I took that seriously when it came to other experiences from that point on. If somebody asked me to do something, you know, I would try it. And I think that really opened the doors to a lot of experiences that I got to have. One of the things that I told the women was, don't be afraid to try new things. And you also don't have to commit to them forever. You know, I got a little bit of questions on that by saying, you know, they said, well, I don't want to get overcommitted and then I'm not happy then. And I said, you don't commit to doing it forever. If somebody asks you to, you know, run the PTA at school, say, you know what, I'll do that for 6 months, but if it doesn't work for me, you know, I'm going to be done. I'm just giving you warning. Try it, you know, put a time frame out there, and if it doesn't work, then you can say that you didn't commit to doing longer than that. But you may find you really enjoy it or have a gift for organization or love working with kids and their parents. So all of those things are opportunities to find out what your true passion is.
Develop a personal mission statement and then say yes.
Yes.
I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, I loved it. Thanks so much, Lori.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with U.S. Representative Christy Noem. We spoke with her last week.